Jody, back with another episode of the Lumieres podcast. We've been away for a week. I've been off the grid slightly, doing some work, doing some writing, and almost got to the end of a first draft of my book, which is very exciting, really. Whoa, it's been a long time in the making, so feels like a milestone along the way. And in these kind of long-term, this is a very personal project. It feels great to get to a point where I can stop and reassess and maybe bring in some outside help to help me take it further. So that's what I've been doing. And I hope you hope you're well. I hope you're everything is flowing in your life. And today we've got a beautiful conversation for you, which I recorded this week in the kind of magical woodland home of Mr. Mark Golding. I met Mark years ago in Brighton when I was a young web designer, and my friend Guy went around to his house and talked to him about doing a website for his business. And I really remember being struck by the magic in his space, and he had all these different objects, and there was a sense of a curated sense to the place that I found quite magical. And he's a very enchanting man to talk to as well. And I followed his process and his progress over the years, and he's become a real force in what you might call mandala art, or symbolic spiritual healing art. He's producing these pieces of work which are so deeply connected to their intent. I really would, if you've never seen any of Mark's work, I really would urge you to go and check out his website, which is markgolding.co.uk, and just observe and take in some of these pieces, because they really are very special pieces of work. So we had a beautiful chat, and Mark was very gracious and warm, and he spoke at length about some very personal stories in his life and how they've affected his worldview. And I'm very grateful for him for sharing in that such a beautiful way. I think many people who listen to this are going to find it deeply moving, and there's a lot of very real wisdom in his words. So I would urge you to have a listen to this one when you can really soak it in and take it in in chunks. There's a lot going on, but there's some really deep concepts and very important messages, I think, dotted throughout this episode. So I hope you enjoy it. To get us in the mood, I'm going to start with a piece of music which comes from Gary Malkin's album Unspeakable Grace, and it's called The End of Suffering, and it was reworked into a slightly different form called The Great Bell Chant, featuring Phat Nhem and Thich Nhat Hanh, who are leading figures in certain parts of Buddhist philosophy. And it's just a beautiful piece of music, and it features some spoken word. So we'll have that to get us into the mood, and we'll go straight into Mark Golding. Thanks, everybody. Be well. Thank you.
May the sound of this bell penetrate deep into the cosmos. Even in the darkest spots, living beings are able to hear it clearly, so that all suffering in them cease, understanding come to their heart, and they transcend the path of sorrow and death. The universal Dharma door is already open. The sound of the rising tide is heard clearly. The miracle happens. A beautiful child appears in the heart of a lotus flower. One single drop of this compassionate water is enough to bring back the refreshing spring to our mountains and rivers.
Nghe chuông phiền não tan mây khói, lặng thân an miệng mỉm cười. Hơi thở nương chuông về chấn niệm vườn tâm hoa.
Listening to the bell, I feel the afflictions in me begin to dissolve. My mind calm, my body relax. A smile is born on my lips. Following the sound of the bell, my breath brings me back to the safe island of mindfulness. In the garden of my heart, the flowers of peace bloom beautifully.
Tiếng chuông huyền diệu.
feel a bit like I'm in a magical cave being in here. There's kind of symbology, artifacts. It feels very rich and alive in this space. And is it something you said you'd, by living in this kind of slightly, I mean, you are a bit isolated really, aren't you? But it's a deliberate act to live somewhere like this. Was it a deliberate act to also make it such a magical space? I mean, rather than just a functional space.
Yeah. The circumstances that drew me here were so astonishing that I had to understand that it was part of my life's journey and part of my spiritual path. So the sort of symbology and statuary that you see around the place are sort of placed and encoded with sort of alignments that are intended to activate my higher perception of what on one level is a cabin in the woods, but from another level could be a sacred space.
Mm.
So everything in here has been placed with consideration, with a geometrical alignment.
Yeah, I can feel that sense of geometrical alignment. And you also referred to it just now and before we turned the recorder on as a ship, which I really like the metaphor of. The kind of magic that you're creating here is quite visible now in the world due to your mandala work. And we were just about to touch on the origin of that work, which for people who haven't seen it is quite astonishing, really. I mean, it's your output for a start is amazing. How much you've managed to kind of get through it always kind of blows me away. It seems like the speed at which you produce these things is quite amazing, considering the intricacy that they must, you know, the dedication, the time, the energy, the intricacy that it must take to create this thing. And also the intent, which each one seems to be a bit of a magical work in itself, like with a different intent. Is that the case? Or?
Yeah. I don't consider it to be an amazing output. I see it as a constant diary or a constant journal. Because when I work, I consider the point where my pen or pencil or ink touches the paper as a loci, as a focus for my intention.
Mm.
So in as much as we sort of sit or travel or work throughout our day and we have random thoughts about which direction we're going in, what we've got to do later, who we've got to meet, shopping lists and stuff, when I sit and draw, my mind is pretty still, and that's necessary because one has to have a steady hand. So there's this kind of relationship between mind and body that's symbolised by the presence of the pen on the paper.
Mm.
So I enter a sort of quasi-meditational space, and so the time disappears. It's not a matter of how much I can do in a certain amount of time.
Right.
It's more a matter of keeping my mind on what I want to achieve. And I consider this point on the paper to be this constant journal or diary of my experience. So, you know, I have written, but I tend to draw more than I write these days. And the thread that links between the very first drawing I did several years ago to where I am now is a representation of the evolution, perhaps, of my own recognition of the matrix within which we reside. So it's on one level, it's a mirror of my relationship to my body, my relationship to my friends and family, my relationship to where we live, my relationship to the world, and my relationship to the universe. And these geometrical forms serve in a manner that tend to find alignments between potentials, and as such I feel to, if there is validity to my life and experience, I should journal it in one way or another. So it happens to be that drawing is my primary means of communication is through the value of art primarily received through the eyes. Mm. So these drawings are what I call medicine to be taken through the eyes, so visual medicines.
Have you drawn since you were a kid, or what's your history with the actual, did you do art at school and that kind of stuff, or did you come to it later on as part of a longer journey?
I did art at school, but you know, didn't do anything with it for decades.
Yeah.
And it was about 7 years ago that I had a chance encounter with somebody, and I was inspired to start to draw. And I can tell you what happened. I was at a party, and I was sat on a sofa with a friend, a girlfriend called Karen Morrison. I sat with Karen, and we're just chatting at the party, having a drink, and sat on a sofa. And hi, Karen, nice to see you. How are you? And she said, I've got cancer. Whew. I've got cancer in my... I said, oh, okay. And I said, whereabouts is the cancer? And she said, oh, in my right breast. And she gesticulated to the general area of her right breast. Mm. And I said, well, whereabouts exactly? And she said, I don't want to go there.
Oh, right.
Which is kind of understandable. Though at the same time, I thought to myself, if I had a cancer, I would want to find the very epicentre, the critical centre of that cancer, and try and engage with the very nub, the nexus of the condition. And I kind of resolved at that time, I considered this for a little while, but pretty soon afterwards, I thought I'd draw a map of what I thought a cancer would look like or feel
specifically
like.
Specifically
for Karen. That was the initial, but Karen subsequently died before I'd done this. It was, you know, it was pretty end game when I met her.
Right.
And so I thought, what I'd try and do is try and draw some map whereby she could be hypnotised or plant medicined or something, and she would be guided into the very heart of the condition. Because in the sort of esoteric sort of understanding that I kind of understand, in inverted commas, I saw that the body is a system, is a complete system, and I saw the metaphor of the cancer as being like a blocked drain, let's say, a blockage. And I considered that the body was like a big block of flats or something.
Yeah.
And should the toilet in the middle of the block of flats get blocked and not be cleared, gradually all the systems, all the tubes would fill until the whole block of flats was full of crap.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought the point would be to get your hand down that toilet and go where you don't want to go.
Sure.
And deal with this thing
in the darkest place. Yeah.
In the darkest place. And so I decided to draw a map of how she could look at this map and kind of be guided in. Wow. To overcome her fears as well of the condition. And that's the very reason I started drawing. And I had this kind of concept in my mind of imaginary medicines, and thinking that everything man-made, woman-made, in this world begins in someone's imagination. The great cathedrals of the world, they started with one person's imagination, you know, the architect's imagination. So the architect sort of conceives, oh, I'm going to build a temple or a pyramid or a house or design a car or whatever they want to do. And they have this sort of spark of imagination. They then represent that aspect of their imagination in two dimensions on paper, you know, rotate this through various sort of perspectives.
Yeah.
Then as a result of that, the builders can build the structure and ultimately the building is built.
The form
comes to life. And I was like, okay, well, what to me, what was the harm in imagining a medicine that doesn't exist. So, yep, because who knows, in the future, maybe such a medicine will manifest. And at the very least, it's an interesting intellectual and metaphysical exercise to play with.
Sure.
And so subsequently, I did the drawing after Karen died. But, it you know, in this conversation now, her journey, her suffering, her death is opening up something many, many years, maybe 6-7 years since she died. Mm. The conversation about my brief relationship with her and the identification of the potentials of imaginary medicines has taken on, taken over my whole life.
Yeah.
Actually, I have no desire for a specific outcome either. I don't hold store in what I do as having validity outside the construct of my own mind. But at the same time, things, you know, in the nature of things, one can plant a seed and we don't know when it's ripened. I've got a lovely little story of a friend of mine, Roger Davey, who's a fellow Springs fan. So we met through working with water. His brother worked for the, I think, British Telecom, and they were digging the streets up in Chichester. And his brother found a Roman pot that had been buried for 2,000 years in the middle of Chichester. Mm. So they found this amazing relic and they took it to the local museum, you know, Chichester Museum, who cleaned it. And inside they found two acorns buried for 2,000 years.
Wow.
And they planted these two acorns and they both grew. And one of them is now at Kew Gardens.
Wow. Okay.
So for me, the story was, okay, it doesn't matter when things happen, when the time's right, when the causes and conditions come together, the seed can ripen. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter to me if this imaginary medicine remains buried and dormant till the end of time. I'm not going to see the end of time, probably. But the seed, we don't know these days, do we? We don't know these days. But the seed is there,
yeah,
awaiting for that person to dig it out of the ground.
Yeah.
So that is sucker to my process.
And also time, you know, time obviously is how we perceive it in a linear construct for the most part. So this medicine, as you're suggesting, may work on levels that are outside of that framework. In which case that almost goes beyond the understanding of how it might manifest, you know. But I really like what you said about not being attached to any outcomes, and I think like being in that place, that's a really pure place to create from. And are there any other practices that you talk about? Are you alluding to kind of Eastern mysticism before in your previous kind of spiritual things that have influenced you over the course of your life? So I'm wondering if are there practices that you that help you get into that space of when you're creating without, you know, thinking in too much in the mind of what is this outcome going to be, or and so you can allow that whatever it is to be born can be born through you. Are there any practices that you tend to turn to with any regularity to help that process?
Yeah. I studied and trained in Buddhist philosophy and meditation for 13 years. I qualified as a teacher of meditation and Tibetan Buddhism. And the one of the sort of, there's many tenets, but one in particular is no action is ever wasted. And what this implies, and the word action in this sense means actions of body, speech and mind.
Mm.
So for every action of body, there's a reaction. So we act with our body, whether it's I cast a little wave because I'm flapping my hand or I move an object. There's literally a reaction to that or an effect from that. Similarly with speech,
yeah,
you know, I can easily offend, or I can
sure.
I can be polite, and so there's a cause and effect as karma is described, of course. And primarily, both actions of body and speech arise from mind. So we kind of have a thought, so we speak, or we have a thought, and we speak, and we act. So I always rescind to no action is ever wasted. So I actually feel that there's ultimate potential in any action of thought. Any action of thought, I don't know, I can't see the ramifications of thought, but I can see how thought changes the entire dynamic of the world one way or another. And so the clearer and cleaner one's intention is aligned in the thought process, the more potency it has. It's not mixed with kind of like a little bit of this, a little bit of what I want, what I don't want. Of course, I'm sort of burdened with that kind of issue because I've not sort of attained great attainments. But it's a form of training of keeping my mind as clear as I can, as often as I can throughout the day. So it's kind of back to basics, all the time. And when I draw, if I, you know, sometimes I draw for 10 minutes without a break, sometimes 10 seconds, it depends on the flow. But as soon as I feel my mind drifting off of pure intention, it's like, it's time to put the pen down, step outside, you know, make a cup of tea, scratch my head. And then I've got to sort of, okay, back in and do it again.
Well, I think that's very, when you put it like that, I think for anyone who's seen the work that comes out of that process, it's very clear. It's very clear. You know, the work itself is very clear. It's impeccable in its detail and in its kind of structural forms. And it doesn't surprise me that that plays a big role in how you approach the creative process. Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, we're talking about the clarity of mind, and then there's so much art that's been created through you know, changing consciousness from one way or another over the years. And how do you see those two states? Like, is that when people say, for example, use alcohol or drugs or plants, or, you know, to put themselves in a receptive state of being, so they might have access to some creativity? How does that compare to the kind of purity of just a breath-based meditation practice or something like that for you? Do you see those as being different things or just on a spectrum? Or,
well, there can be a relationship between the two, in as much as from my understanding, you know, my training, my discipline, there's both sutra and tantra. Sutra are ostensibly public open teachings or lessons, and tantra are secret in as much as they're kind of like, they're not on the shelf. They are a bit these days, but the sort of the higher tantras are quite obscure,
like mystical.
Yeah. And one of the processes of tantra is the transformation. So what is considered a poison can be a medicine if applied skillfully. But there's great danger in the use of alcohol, drugs, various processes whereby one cannot maintain mindfulness. And if one cannot maintain mindfulness, the power, you've given your stuff away, you know. Sure. There's kind of no point to it. So for those that want to use those methodologies, personally, you know, I play about a little bit now and again, but I've kind of, it's not necessarily my strict path. You know, high days and holidays, perhaps I play around a bit, but it's not for everyday work.
Yeah.
I don't think it serves me well to use those tools.
Sure.
Frequently, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for just kind of giving me, it just came to me and I just wanted to expand on that. So I want to go back to what we were just talking about the origins of how you came to start drawing. And we were talking about cancer and your friend Karen. And it's something, you know, cancer, like, you know, is something that's touched my life early on and touched your life through various avenues. So I wonder if you would mind kind of going back to the story of how that experience, what that brought to the creation of the art that you now make.
Well, I think I've got this kind of overwhelming desire to see a miracle that in part I have contributed to. Mm. Yeah, of course, there's miracles happening 24/7 in every corner of the universe. And I have this sort of desire to see something happen and to be a sort of part choreographer towards a great miracle. And I've seen this aspect of physical cancer in many people, of course. And I also feel that the world is riddled with, cancer of anger, jealousy, ignorance. You know, in this world today, there's this sort of sense that there's something wrong. Why can't we get on and do things? Mm. And so the initial journey with Karen's intended mandala has grown to a bigger thing where I want to see the entire world transformed. And so this is even a bigger, crazier dream. But I don't feel that there's any reason why this potential, in fact, there is no reason why this potential cannot manifest. And I'm sure there are thousands, if not millions, of people around the world that are working assiduously through shamanic methods, through methods of Dharma, through methods of Christianity, through methods of Islam, people of faith and the crazies that are working towards this, whose voices kind of somewhat submerged by the volume and angry chatter that's filling the world today. So I see it as a much deeper process that I'm trying to be part of. You know, I don't see myself as an initiator of it, but as a contributor to that wish. And the way the world seems to be moving at the moment, there's this kind of crazy swing that's happening now, but to me that's grist for my mill. The every time I sort of look at the news on my laptop or on my phone, it's like, what? Mm. More crazy stuff. And it's like, okay, that just means the likes of you and I have got to, okay, understand more the nature of what it is, because ultimately I see everything in this world, I share a responsibility for everything in this world because my consciousness is directly connected to everything in this world. Yeah. So if there's big crap happening wherever it is in the world, somehow I'm part responsible for the continuation of that. So it's almost like I offer myself up to be a sponge that's rinsed and screwed clean, you know, all the gunge washed out of it. And if I can clear the gunge out of the deepest recesses of my mind, somehow the entire world will reflect that clarity that I found within. Mm. And this is the teaching of the great sages of the time. You know, it's kind of do the work on yourself and the rest will follow. Yeah. You know, I can't tidy up everyone's back garden or speak to everyone in the world, and I don't actually wish to do that. But if I can clear myself, then gradually the ripples will and do spread. You know, no action is wasted.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, big stuff coming up. Well, okay, I've got to plant a more subtle alchemical or homeopathic seed ahead of what's coming to try and dilute that. And so there's a very crazy, probably indescribable strategy I have of these stepping stones of potential.
Sure.
That are kind of gradually forming. You know, if I've drawn thousands of mandalas, there is a structure that connects them all. There is a process, and eventually, probably not too far away, I want to create a mandala of mandalas where the totality of my process is recorded in some sort of zoomable thing.
Ooh, I like that. Very fractal.
Yeah.
So would they, have you kind of got an idea of that already in your mind's eye, or is that something that would happen as you create it?
I think I've got the ingredients. Most of the ingredients are ready, and it's a matter of the appropriate time it will happen, or I will instigate it, or it will instigate me. Mm. I've learned certain aspects of the practice of patience, whereby I don't try and invest too much hope in the timeline. It's, you know, yeah, it's this, like, you know, I want it now, man. I want it now.
That's such a human thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's like, no, just be patient, just be patient. And, you know, because of the nature of how we live, we don't have to, we're not, we don't have to sort of spend too much time in the world earning money and dealing with the normal things of life, even though we have lead perfectly normal lives where we live. But somehow I can invest more time and energy in what I think is more important than the sort of basics of money, food, home, heating, insurance, all that kind of stuff.
It feels almost to me like your being in a place like this is entirely what you need to get clearer on your vision and to get clearer in your production of this kind of what is really magical art or magical acts. So it feels very fitting that this is, you know, this environment is that you've dedicated as a sacred space. That this is in effect your studio as well as your home, your kind of, it's your portal to the world. And you were talking just a minute ago about the clearing out of the crap, and some people who've looked into the spring in Hastings, where you literally took part in clearing the crap. People who may have visited there, it's called St Helens Spring. It's in St Helens Wood in Hastings. And Mark, you were kind of instrumental in the clearing away, the regeneration of this holy space, I guess you'd say. So how did that? Because I'm fascinated by this, and also the magical underpinnings that seem to revolve around it. I mean, how did you first come to find the spring? Were you just on a walk?
Okay, so this happened about 7 years ago, 6-7 years ago, and the story is that my son Gus was 21 at the time, and he became extremely ill. Extremely ill, sort of life and death ill. Was in hospital for several months, and between myself, my daughter Coral, Gus's partner Natalie, and my ex-wife Julie, we would sit by his bedside. There would almost always someone by his bedside. Natalie, the angel, took the sort of the greatest burden of this. So we'd travel up. I was living in Brighton at the time. I'd travel up to London, and Gus was desperately ill, and we didn't really know if he'd recover. It was kind of very, very difficult times. And I had a girlfriend, my partner at the time, Samantha, lived in Hastings. And at weekends, I'd go and stay with her, and I probably wasn't very good company at the time. So I'd go for walks in nearby St Helens Woods. And one day I was walking through the woods, kind of very despondent, and I noticed a little brook, a little rivulet by the side of the path, and the surface of the water was sort of scummy and, you know, mucky, and for no apparent reason I sort of clambered down the bank and I cleared some of this debris from the stream. And, you know, about 6 foot of rubbish I cleared out of this little stream, and immediately I felt a certain sense of relief and release. And I noticed two things. I noticed the water began to sing, in as much as the water that was silent and very slow moving started to bubble and play. And so I was, oh, the music, the water starting to sing to me. And then I also noticed the water started to dance, because the water became more activated and the sunlight was reflecting on the water. So I noticed the song and dance of the water that I'd never experienced before in my life. And very sort of quietly pleased with myself and sort of, you know, it was a nice little bit of medicine and went off and went back to Samantha's house. And then I kind of thought about it for a few days, and next time I went to see Samantha, I'm going to go back to the woods. I'm going to actually do a bit more of that. So I went back to the woods and kind of got stuck in for a couple of hours, clearing, removing rubbish, removing debris, and really enjoyed doing it. It was kind of good medicine for me. No construct, no reason.
Physical action.
Physical action. Seeing something beautiful after seeing something dirty. It's like sort of cleaning, doing your laundry or something. Everything's sort of,
it's a good feeling.
And I did this for maybe 3 or 4 weeks without understanding or reason. And then I had this snap correlation where, as I saw the 65 acres of St. Helens Woods, I saw that potentially as a map of Gus's lungs. Gus had a lung condition.
Did that just come to you?
Yeah, just
popped out.
Just in a moment. And I thought, okay, so the potential is if I clear every single brook and tributary in these 65 acres, if I follow all the paths of all the water flows throughout the woods, there might be one twig or one broken bottle or one dead animal or whatever that represents this tiny trigger in the same metaphor as I talked about with
the house.
With the house, you know,
the flats,
the blockage in the flats. There might be one bit,
one pipe
that opens it up. So as soon as I had that vision, I lost the plot. Well, I gained the plot. And it's like, right, I'm going to clear every single part. And I had something to do as well, rather than kind of mope about and be sort of miserable.
Bit of a mission.
And so I did this for 2 or 3 months, every weekend, probably from dawn till dusk, Saturdays and Sundays. I'd be in the woods clearing this stuff up because I kind of felt that there was nothing I could do on a practical, pragmatic level, i.e. help Gus get better, but there was the potential to work magic. And someone suggested, oh, you're embarking upon a shamanic journey. And I kind of dismissed this on one level, but it kind of had validity, you know, as the story unfolded. So I kind of worked at this for 2 or 3 months, clearing these blockages, but nothing really seemed to change much. And then I think it was in the February or March, it was a super full moon, and it was about 10 or 11 at night, and I decided to take an alchemical journey, and I was compelled to take this alchemical journey and voyage to the woods. So I kind of was a little bit intimidated by, okay, but I was driven. I was drawn to take this journey. So I took myself to the woods, big full moon, magical, beautiful experience, you know, 11 or 12 at night, you know owls and all this kind of old magic stories. And I remembered there was one part of the woods that always held a terror for me, a fear. There was, you know, like the bad juju spot, you know, the bit that we don't like to go to. So I resisted, but I had to go there. I had to go there. So I sort of remembered this place and terrified. I climbed down the riverbank, down the stream, and found myself in this kind of evil, in inverted commas, place in the woods where I had to come and meet the demons of the woods, the great, you know, horror stories of all fairy stories.
Yeah.
So I climbed into this space and with a mounting panic and terror until what appeared to be for a million years later, I found myself absolutely enclosed by terror. Absolutely enclosed by terror. And I realised there was no room for manoeuvre from these demons, you know, the great horrors that we all have of fairy stories, monsters, you know, demons. And I reached a point where I couldn't prevent them coming inwards into my consciousness. And at that moment, I decided the only thing I can do is welcome them all in and embrace them with a mind of love. And I did this and instantly they transformed. Instantly, I was, there are no demons. There's no bad juju in the woods. There are no goblins and things. They're just figments of my imagination that kind of keep me away from my truth. And kind of, you know, clambered out of that hole a couple of hours later, sort of weeping with joy, and kind of wandered back out into the woods. And I was walking through the woods. It's probably about 2 a.m. or something, and, you know, completely alone. And I came to a yew tree. I came to a yew tree, and I don't know why, but I do have connections with yew trees. Mm. I sat under this yew tree and prayed to Gaia, to the yew tree, to St. Helens Woods, to God, to Buddha, to whoever. And I made a promise, the most solemn promise I could make. If you're to help me with my son, or to help my son, I will spend the rest of my life in service. This was a complete and utter, this is not negotiable deal. Yeah. It's like I signed the pact, so to speak, and kind of sobbed and made this prayer and stood up from under this yew tree. And then I had a vision. I had a vision that there was a lost spring somewhere. Somewhere there was a place that was the source of all this. And I knew the woods very well, but there was no spring. You know, and I asked, the next week or so, I asked people walking their dogs, you know, people that kind of looked at me as I was clearing all these through, the, what you're doing. And I said, is there a spring? And he went, no, no, there's no spring, no spring. And then a week or so later, I was in Brighton. I went to a bookshop, an old bookshop, and found an old Ordnance Survey map of St, you know, that had features of St Helens. And I found this code SPR, which is the Ordnance Survey for spring. And this was in a part of the woods that was kind of slightly separate, for you had to go across a path. So ostensibly, it was like bordered off from the rest of the woods. It didn't seem to bear a relationship to the woods. It was sort of blocked off. And it was blocked off with ferocious brambles, ivy, nettles, fallen trees. It was absolutely abandoned. No one went in there. It was kind of impenetrable. You know, I did penetrate it, but it was impenetrable. Yeah. So I sort of like, okay, this is for me to find out. So I kind of clambered through, crawled through the brambles, scratched and cut and, you know, filthy, and found myself into this kind of semi-open space. But it stunk. There were three, what I would describe as swamps, full of putrid, fetid, rank filth. Absolutely disgusting. Mm. And I kind of thought, oh, there's no spring here, but I knew there was something there. So for the next couple of weeks, I went up and started to drain these swamps by making little tunnels and forms and trying to guide the sort of the swamp-like waters, you know, the filthy, filthy, repulsive stuff. It was worse than a toilet. And gradually over a few weeks, the surface of the swamps dropped a foot or two, and because it started to drain, and I noticed a trickle out of the corner of my eye across one side, and knew that I'd found what I was looking for. And so I kind of made my way across there very tentatively and started to clear what I thought the source was. And, you know, I was expecting a, you know, little crack in the ground or something. And I found this sort of stone channel. Then I did all this by bare hands. And then I found the edge of a stone wall, a curved stone wall, and realised that I'd found something. So this time I had to sort of go off and buy a shovel, because it was and I'd spent all the work I'd done in the woods I'd done with my bare hands. There was kind of this metaphor of suffering involved in the purity of the work I was trying to do. If my hands were cut and bleeding and I was, you know, bruised and damaged, I thought, well, this is a small price to pay. I've got to do this. And it was a self-healing as well. And then subsequently excavated the spring and found this gorgeous, remarkable place. And at that point, I realised that this was an act of magic, but I was guided to do this. I wasn't a great person that had the vision. I was just the vulnerable, weak person that was guided to release this flow, this blockage. So at that point, I realised that magic has validity in this world, as much as it's decried and laughed at and ignored. The potential to achieve what is ostensibly a minor miracle is real. And my dream at the time was, once I'd cleared the water, was that my son would leave hospital and come and drink from the spring.
Wow.
And subsequently he did, you know, and it's kind of, it's now got a life of its own. Mm. So, and it was this sense of potential that, because it was like a fairy story.
Yeah.
It was a complete fairy story, that it's the sort of thing that the myth and legend or whatever. And so I was like, okay. And this was in alignment with my Buddhist faith, in as much as everything I did, every time I started, every time I finished working in the woods, I'd start with the intention of working with love, wisdom and compassion. That's all I wanted. That all I wanted to come from it. And if that resulted in healing or whatever, it didn't matter how it manifested. So everything subsequently that flows from that spring over the course of the work I did is imbued with love, wisdom and compassion. And this flows to this day, still transporting this kind of magical intention into the world as we speak now.
Mm. It's a beautiful, like you say, it is. It has all the energetics of that very real story, feel very very mythological, very transpersonal. There's this, I mean, I think that's why maybe people really connect to that, and it's a beautiful thing. I think that that the rebirth of that spring through your acts have come in such a, it feels like there's a legend already, you know, in the making there, of how this has come to be rediscovered. It's a very, feels very woven into that place, that place was waiting to be rediscovered. It was always waiting for the right person to come along, or the person who was most kind of right for the job, maybe. Yeah, so now it's kind of people go there as a place of worship from time to time, and it's become kind of a focal point of this compassionate energy that you were just talking about in those woods.
Yeah, I kind of saw it as you know, I lived in Hastings and St Leonard's for a couple of years, and I always felt that there was a sort of dark, dense energy. You know, it's got a very mixed.
A lot of people say that
mixed sort of energies there. And I kind of thought, okay, this is the highest source of fresh water in the town, and to me I thought, okay, this is opening the crown chakra of the town, and the spring itself is in the grounds, or that used to be in the grounds. The areas have changed a little bit, but it was originally in the grounds of a derelict 8th century church. So just behind the spring, there's a derelict church that was built in the 8th century. So there's this kind of deep history of that place. And I actually feel the spring goes back before that the church was built. It almost certainly was. And in terms of reference to the town, I think there's deep symbolism in the town, in as much as I feel that, you know, the 1066 story, the Battle of Hastings, is that I know that either William or Harold would have been to this spring, or they would. It's the high spring. It's the clearest water on the top of a hill, overlooking Hastings. You know, the topography would be slightly different then, of course.
Sure.
But I thought, so in terms of British narrative history, this spring they must have camped there. They, you know, the high point where there's fresh water. It's kind of, it's inconceivable that there wouldn't have been defences or it wouldn't have been taken. It's kind of, so it plays this, in my mind, it plays this pivotal role in the history of European history and particularly British and English history. So there's this kind of like, okay, there's this, and the church was founded in the 8th century. So this goes before the Battle of Hastings. So there's this sense of Albion, of Avalon, these kind of great mythical stories of how the land was so beautiful and powerful. And it seems to play some tiny role in the resuscitation of the dream of Albion or the vision of Albion, of Avalon.
So it's got these multiple layers of meaning, of impact.
Yes.
Did this kickstart your relationship with water?
Yes.
Which it seems is something very dear to you from the little that I do know of the things that you post and share and things like that. This was the start of that relationship.
Absolutely.
Conscious relationship.
Yeah. I learned so much through watching the water to move. So having cleared a bit, I'd go back a week or two later and I'd see things transformed. And I remember going to the woods and then, you know, certain bits 6 months later or a year later, and I'd see the banks change. There'd be a different form of life there. There'd be a renewed vigour, because this song of the music and dance of the music produces very interesting qualities. So, for instance, when the dance of the water, the light reflects within what might have been a very shady, dark, dank canopy.
Yep.
But because the light was reflected and balanced inside, dispersed, new life would come to these dark places. So a year later, there'd be plants growing where nothing grew. And this kind of like, okay, so the water has brought life to this place. And similarly, the song of the music, as the water started to increase in flow, it's almost like a drumming on the ground. So a metaphor is if you go to the beach, you'll see seabirds stamping on the beach and the worms come up.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's the drumming that makes things come up. And similarly, because the light and this subtle drumming sound started, it's okay, what's going on over there? And insects are attracted to this process. Other animals, birds are attracted to it too. So it's like a drumming on the ground whereby the heartbeat is increased.
So it's like a kind of like a frequency of vibration that is emitted from the space. Once it's kind of
amplified.
Alive.
Yes. All predicated now upon love, wisdom and compassion that are going down these kind of countless little rivulets and brooks and streams that run down to the sea, to the English Channel, of course. So, of course, as all this process is going on, the wishes I've intended to serve are being transmitted into the great oceans, into the body of all waters. So this kind of was grist for my mill, realizing that, okay, this is a way that literally the ripple effect or butterfly effect can manifest. So, you know, there's the work of Dr. Emoto that most people have heard of, water carries intention. And so it's like, okay, I can work with that concept. It's not alien to my understanding. So why not work with water, knowing that it has the power to transform the subtle molecular structures attached to water? And subsequently, water has become... And it's interesting how other friends of mine, one friend in particular, is now clearing springs in London. Other people are doing water work pretty much around the world, you know, very subtly, quietly. But this is, it almost felt like I was sort of guided to serve as a signal. And the signal was that you start to clear a blockage and you never know what you're going to find. You know, I had not the faintest idea what I was going to find. And I'd say it's the same for anybody that's working, clearing something. You find an old pile of rubbish or something, you clear it. You don't know what's at the bottom. You assume you know, and 990 times out of 100, there's nothing there. But occasionally there's something of beauty that's hidden and obscured. And it's kind of in the metaphor of obscurity, you know, Sleeping Beauty, these kind of, it's like those that go into the darkest, muckiest places have the most chance of bringing something to light, you know, but you've got to be prepared to do that. So, yeah, there's friends that are working with water around the world, and there's so many little subtle stories of water, and one that kind of sticks with me is Leonardo da Vinci. I'll quasi quote here. He said, "If you put your hand into running water, you touch the last thing that has been, and the first thing that is yet to come." The last thing that has been and the first thing that is yet to come. And that there's truth in that. That's not a metaphysical that's not a metaphysical understanding. That's a physical recognition
of a moment.
Put your hand into a flowing stream. Yep, that's gone, and oof, that's coming. And this kind of putting the hand in the stream in the sort of Leonardo type way is what I do when I put my pen onto paper. Ooh. I'm putting my pen tip into the stream of whatever this stuff is we live in. I'm putting my pen into the stream, my pencil into the stream, touching the next thing that's meant to, that's about to be. So I'm kind of, in my construct, I'm actually planting a seed in this kind of matrixy stuff that we, this soup that we inhabit. So these things came together in that way.
Is that principle something, do you feel like, has guided your, the way you've lived your life to this point? In terms of, I know, I think you've kind of had an interesting journey to where you are today. And maybe you could touch on a little bit about how that journey has kind of unfolded for you. Has it been something that was as simple as feeling that, you know, that desire to put the finger into the stream, as you say, that's kind of led you, or did you have more of a kind of mental feeling about you know, your path through life?
Well, it's a combination of the two. I'm both passive and active in my process. You know, there's sort of apparent forces external to me with which I have no means of engagement or comprehension. And it's the application of the finger in the river or the pencil on the paper that is my active part in the process. And that kind of leads us to why we are sitting in this place having this conversation now. And for 20 plus years, practicing Buddhist, and as I mentioned, Tantra earlier, I practice a sadhana, which is a prayer to a female Buddha called Vajragini. And you'll see a picture there and a sculpture behind me. And I've been practicing this sadhana, this prayer, for 20 plus years. And this is exactly why I'm here. And the story of why we're here, we are here, is that, about 2.5 years ago, I was at a party in Lewis at Zoo, and I met a beautiful woman called Helena. And I'll just rewind a week before that, 2 weeks before that. I came to this land where we're sitting, and I came to a festival, Into the Wild. This is 3 years ago this August. And I came to the festival with my daughter, Coral, and my granddaughter, Ava. And we met up here on, you know, Saturday day, had a lovely day, you know, eating raw pizzas and, you know, throwing sticks and doing stuff that you do at festivals. And come about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, it started to get a bit dark. The fire was going in the middle, and Coral and Ava, they needed to go home. And I was like, okay, festival, I'm quite happy to stay. You know, I'll rock up and stay all night. And I kind of sat around the fire in the middle of the meadow, and I thought, okay, it's kind of all right, a bit sort of not quite my scene. You know, I might go home. I'm not sure if I want to sit here. And then someone said, oh, did I know there was a fire in the woods? There was a fire in the woods. And okay, it's a bit more my style, you know, a little bit off-piste, you know. And so I kind of found my way into the woods, and there's about 40 people sat around this blazing fire, you know, and this lovely sort of process of, you know, people reciting poetry, you know, and singing around the fire, playing guitar, telling stories, and all these kind of lovely fireside-y events, you know, dark, enclosed and a bit magical. And I sort of sat there, and evening went on, and about sort of, I don't know what time, 3 or 4 in the morning, there were just 3 people left around the fire, me and these other 2 guys. And we ended up having this beautiful, profound conversation, pretty much out of the blue. But we had different understandings, different faiths, different traditions, but that just didn't matter a fig. It was just no important, because we found this common ground. And the common ground, we were sat round a fire, as people have done for millennia. And one of the fellas there, who's become a good friend, I met him that day at Adil. We were sharing stories of, you know, myths and legends and things. And Adil told me that in the Hindu traditions, fire, people sit around a fire because fire is considered to be, cannot be tainted, in as much as we humans can mess up the water, mess up the earth, mess up the air. But fire necessarily is always pure, always clean. And he said also in these Hindu traditions, the fire is considered to be the library, hold a library of everything that has ever been spoken round a fire, an open fire, is taken into the great library of conversations and magic and music and dance and theatre and grieving and all these processes.
Oh, that's a beautiful idea.
And so when we sit and talk around a fire, we are contributing to the library, but we can draw from the library. So we know how many times someone, I've never sung before, and they get the guitar around the fire. I've never done this before.
Sure.
So everybody has seen, they have this sort of capacity to sort of reach into themselves. And so we had this kind of beautiful conversation that went on all night. And at about sort of 7 or 8 in the morning, I kind of stumbled out of the woods and absolutely exhausted, didn't sleep all night, but I didn't want to, and left there, came back into the meadow, and I was exhausted, and I kind of thought, I'd love to explore this land further, but a lot of people here, it's kind of not really my style. I'm a bit of a kind of quiet person most of the time. I'm noisy in certain times. And I kind of had this desire to come back and revisit these woods, and kind of thought, oh, it's not going to happen, never mind. So fast forward again to the party at Zoo. I met Helena and we're talking, oh, hi, you know, nice to meet you. And within 5 minutes, she told me that she lived on this land, in the woods.
Where you've just been, yeah.
In the woods. And I'd love to come and have a look around the woods. I'd love to explore that. I had such a profound night. I want to know more about that place. You know, I felt I had a similar feeling when I was here on this land as I had to when I was in St. Helens. There's something of great power, of majesty, mysticism, ancient magic that I kind of wanted to touch and feel and experience and work with, and whatever that meant. And she said, oh, come around, you know, come around in a couple of weeks. I'll cook you some dinner and I'll show you the woods. I'll show you what I know. Fantastic. So with regards to the Buddhist aspect of this part of the memory, is that I practiced this sadhana, this prayer, for 20 plus years. And there was one line in the sadhana, one particular aspect of the prayer, where the aspirant, i.e. myself, wishes to meet the goddess, the Buddha, the deity, that lives in the forest hut beyond words, thoughts and expressions. Helena said, oh, this is where I'm living, da, 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 and came. And instantly I knew that this was what I've been praying for 20 years.
Ooh, wow.
The forest hut beyond words, thoughts and expressions.
Mm.
And had this instant recognition of, I've been drawn here for a reason. I wouldn't have felt this sensitivity with the land had I not done the work for years in St. Helens. and this land is now calling me as a servant, as part of my fulfillment of my promise to spend the rest of my life in service. Mm-hmm. So subsequently, we've been here for a couple of years, and every day I'm in service to this land, this place, but by proxy to Gaia. This is just a node on the surface of the planet, as there are trillions of nodes on this planet. But for some reason, there's this alignment of my prayers, of my work with intention, love, wisdom, compassion, of wishing to heal, and my service that are focused right here, right now. And they have been, and my drawings are a sort of expression of my journey through this work. Because I share my drawings online, but lots of the things I share are photographs. But we do work 24/7 here, really. There's kind of nothing that's out of the remit of my service when I'm here. Mm. Occasionally I muck about, but I'm kind of I'm dedicated to fulfilling, trying to fulfill my potential, which is to, squeeze out my own sponge. Mm. And if that means living off grid and kind of taking the adventure or journey of living kind of in a fairly remote-ish place, I need that space to be able to go deeper, not to be, go to the pub, go do this, go exactly. to town, go to the movies. Of course, we do that from time to time, but it's like, no, we're here and we're here for a reason. And both of us are fully engaged in that process. It's kind of like, and the sort of the next level of metaphor is that I'm seeking in Buddhism and many traditions called enlightenment. And enlightenment can be described as a yoga, and the word yoga, union, and the union ultimately is the union of light and dark, hot and cold, up, down, left, right, a male, female. So to be able to translate this metaphorical journey into an actual experience of a union with a fellow traveller, i.e. Helena, and this is what we intend to achieve, is through very unconventional ways, is to reveal an aspect of the path to enlightenment. And I say this again, it's an unconventional path. For years I did teach formally. I'd sit on a throne and teach people very formally, and I kind of thought, okay, there's a lot of people that in robes and teaching, doing formal teaching, but I thought my role in this entire story of stories is that I must endeavour to reach people that aren't interested in learning the formalities, the long process of sitting for years in meditation. Mm. So is there a way I can shortcut my experience and transpose it and translate it so the message is translated out into the world? And of course, this kind of came a bit with the sort of rise of Facebook and image sharing on Instagram and stuff. Yeah. So it's like, okay, I can start leaving manifest breadcrumbs in the ethers, in the matrix, that will be picked up one way or another in the consistent story of evolution on the planet. Mm-hmm. So and spiritual evolution in particular. So this whole, right at this moment, us facing each other talking is sort of an expression of the potential to attain enlightenment myself, but I don't think that's going to come in the immediate view. It's not going to come in the immediate future, but to lay trails or breadcrumbs that should the great happen, there's a coded path for those that don't want to sit and read literal scriptures for years on end, which I did. But how do you translate that? And it's like, I'll use the metaphor of mandala. And of course, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, mandalas are, they create the sand mandalas. It takes them, a week or so. They create these mandalas out of graded sand. And then at the end of the session, the end of the week, they just...
It's swept away.
It's gone. And so the creation of a mandala for me, I don't throw my mandalas away, but I disregard them in a way, because it's like, okay, I've got to do...
As in you draw a line under them kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like, next one. It's kind of like a continual evolution of a prayer. So this kind of like, and further, this takes me back to a sort of earlier part of the conversation, whereby the essence of Tantra, as I understand it, is whereby we create our own mandala. And I can say that your mandala is your world and universe from your perspective. Mm-hmm. My mandala is my world. And everybody has their individual mandala of kind of, this is the sphere of my experience, okay, that can be drawn in a circular or spherical manner. Mm-hmm. And to translate that and extend that is the tantric path, whereby somebody such as Buddha Shakyamuni, let's say, he translated his, he squeezed his, the gunge out of his sponge and manifested this purity in his life, which is still around the world 2,500 years later. You know, of the trillions of homes in the world, probably, I don't know, tenth of them have got statues of Buddha in them. I, you know, it's kind of a throwaway number. So the potential for the mandala to increase and improve exists. And should, you know, one creates an area of harmony around oneself in one's own home, you know, creating a harmonious inner space, a harmonious home, a harmonious garden, maybe that can translate into a harmonious town or village. We don't know. So these are all grist for my mill, and they're all sort of my MO of working with the unlimited potential that I believe is beneath the layer, the next layer of gunge I've got to go through, you know?
It's interesting when you talk about, it's an interesting one with enlightenment, isn't it? Because it's such a loaded word in spirituality, and so many people can become obsessed by it or become very goal-driven about seeking this magical state of being that somehow then everything's going to be okay, or sometimes it can be a way to avoid the dark places and, you know, the things that are really going on for people. Can you speak to that at all about the kind of the over attachment to wanting something like an enlightenment experience, or how do you know what I'm getting at there?
I can't speak for anybody else. I can't speak for anybody else.
Or more of an observation, perhaps, on maybe how you've observed this in other people you may have seen.
I can, as I say, I can only speak from my own experience, and it's impossible for me to make judgments or observations on that sense, because subjectively it's all part of my experience as well. So if I kind of sneer at someone's over attachment, it's kind of, that's my own relative process. Though for me, my understanding of the attainment of enlightenment is that one, the reason why one does this is to benefit every living being. That's the equation. And so it's like, I've got to pray for, or include in my prayers in inverted commas, every bastard in the world, every swine, every horrible person in the world, as well as the beautiful ones. And I do not know the minds of others, and things are so oblique, and one could judge me by saying I rescind my responsibilities in the world because I don't play an active role in the world. So I can be judged in a way, and it's like, well, you don't actually know my mind. And in the same way, I don't know your mind and I don't know anybody's mind. So I'd refrain from making that judgment. Because if I do, it's like separates me from the... But of course, I have these instinctive thoughts
and reactions. It's not a judgment, I think, so much as an observation of of where other people's paths might have taken them. Or, you know, I've put on a personal level, I've had friends who started off in spirituality becoming extremely goal-driven, you know, and even in meditation becoming goal-driven, and it becomes this kind of, where's the progress? I want to see the progress, rather than being about the infinite potentials of being in the moment, which of course it should be about. Well, I say should, there's no shoulds, but... Yeah, I just observe that sometimes that can be an arc that people go down, and maybe that's their arc to go down, to have that experience, to come back to the realization that they didn't need to be, nothing to look for. You know, it's that old classic.
It's their gunge. It's their crap. Let's say that's their story,
yeah,
of which we all have elements of it.
Sure, exactly.
Necessarily until we're kind of
completely
rinsed. We've got that. But I would say to, anybody that's has an inkling of enlightenment, if it's predicated upon a pure intention, what will manifest ultimately is a pure result.
You don't need to be in a school or have studied Buddhism to have that experience.
No, I don't think so. I mean, let's take the classic Buddha didn't, he figured it out. So there's a matter of receiving the teachings, receiving the understandings, comprehending them, contemplating them, meditating upon them. But they have to be applicable to your own specific, speaking quite strictly here, to your own particular karmic potentials. Everybody has this seed of enlightenment or Godhead within them, necessarily, however deeply obscured it's there. It's necessarily there, and all they have to do, or all one has to do, is work with the pure intention, and gradually the water will start to clear, the mind, the clarity will manifest.
Thank you. I was going to switch it up there. You mentioned you've got a daughter and a granddaughter now. Mm-hmm. So how is kind of the role of grandfather, or the role of how does the role of family feed into your life or into your work, or is that something that's kind of a separate aspect, not a separate aspect, you know what I mean? It's family's here and...
No, completely integrated. I've got two grandchildren now. My daughter, Coral, has two daughters, Ava, who's going to be 5 this year, and Sufi, who's 8 months. And my son Gus, him and his partner Natalie are expecting a baby on the 4th of July.
Wow. That's
and
beautiful.
It's a girl, and they intend to call her Tara. So I have what I consider to be a very beautiful relationship with my children, Coral and Gus. So we've had our share of life's car crashes. My daughter came here last Saturday with her partner Ali and the two girls, and we spent the day in the woods together. Coral loves this place.
I bet the kids absolutely.
Well, this is the just quickly, my son Gus is coming here on Saturday to spend the day because we're going to have a journey day. So So it's kind of a bonding kind of ceremony we're going to do together. And as for the grandchildren, Ava's been coming here she was here when I first came here nearly 3 years ago. And for me, I can play this absolutely archetypal grandfatherly role in her life. And at 4 and a half, magic's real, isn't it? She can wave a stick and the smoke moves, it's magic. And of course, that is what's happening. And I see my children as they're fully aware of my process. They're fully, as we grew up, as they grew up, most people were going to festivals. And for 8 years, we would go to Buddhist festivals. So these completely drink and drug free, people are there to meditate and that's all you go for. So we'd go to these festivals every year. And so they grew up, from, 7 or 8 till 15 or whatever, with that process. So they're completely aware of the spiritual path from a Buddhist perspective, completely aware of it. There's empowerments, teachings, meditations, done all that kind of stuff. They've got their own lives. They do their own things their own way. But we all know, we've got this knowing look that we know what we're all about. So there's nothing alien to my children's understanding of what I do. Very unconventional, but it's like, oh, Dad's doing it again. But at the same time, the fullness of time seems to reveal there was an aspect of wisdom maybe in this crazy, it's called crazy wisdom,
Yeah.
And with Ava and Sufi and Tara, who's yet to be born, I see them as potential. In terms of work, before Ava was born, I did a series of 26 drawings to welcome her to the world. This is before she was born. So normally one does a birth chart after someone's born. I actually thought I'll do a pre-birth chart. So I did a series of drawings to bless or pray for her capacity to be clearer and purer. Mm. And similarly Sufi, I kind of worked all last year on a single project, but the project was called A Medicine for the World. The medicine's there. I choreographed it with mandalas and ritual and ceremony and magic and prayer. I created this kind of literal medicine for the world, but about halfway through the process, in fact, it's exactly halfway through the process, because I started in winter solstice 2015, finished winter solstice 2016. On Midsummer's Day, 21st of June, I had a vision that Sufi was the medicine for the world. It was like, okay, that child is, okay, I don't know how that's going to translate, but it was a very, very clear, a gifted child or whatever. Of course, I'm kind of selfish from that perspective. Oh, yes, of course, yeah, I know that child. But the sort of the signals were so loud that day with Helena that it's like, okay, she's got this gift. There's this deep secret within her that she might manifest. And similarly, Tara, who's being born in July, there's this similar process. So I wish to imbue my grandchildren. My children are kind of sort of got it in a way. Mm. But the my grandchildren, it's like to create this kind of aspect of a mythical, you know, the grandfather that's always jolly and this, that and the other. And I deliberately play that role. But I love playing that role of kind of like showing them, not Sufi yet,
adopting,
she's too young.
The archetype.
Yeah, yeah. And the potential that to live beyond the horizon of your taught expectations, that there's a far bigger arena in which we're playing with than the immediacy of where we live and what we drive and what we eat and who we fancy. Mm-hmm. There's a bigger, bigger perspective. And to imbue that with them is probably my greatest honour. And there's a beauty in it because I won't see it. So I love this idea of this kind of, you know.
Again, we're coming back full circle to the outcome.
Yeah. The 2,000-year-old seed, you know. Mm. It's like, well, okay, da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
But knowing that if one's careful and considerate enough, the chances are that the sort of time loops and spirals and vortexes will kind of align and make that potential arise. I won't see that. And the largest part of me is like, I don't mind. All I've got to do is plough my furrow, so to speak, plant my seeds, work, and inevitably something will conjunct or align that will create that, ripen that effect. And that is the purpose of my work now, is to work in the present, in my own space, with the sort of parameters that I'm kind of withheld by, but knowing that I'm actually working on a subtle level for these children. But these are, they're my grandchildren or our grandchildren, but that's not really the point. It's all children. It's kind
you
of
extrapolate
like,
that yeah, out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the old kind of seven generations time Native American thing that, you know, but it's something that's so not in today's kind of individualistic, there's a lot of selfish things that are only considered that will affect me in my lifetime. You know, the very much needs to be, it would be great if more people were able to adopt that mindset of, I'm not going to do this act or buy this thing or, you know, take this action just because it will suit myself. Maybe I can take this action because it will have a great impact on people in several generations' time. You know, the outcome, and I don't know what the outcome is, but it's not a selfish act. It's something that I'm doing for people who are not born yet.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, not many people, but there are people.
Oh,
you
sure.
Know, you know, and that's the kind of glass half empty, glass half full kind of metaphor. And I kind of, you know, I sometimes amuse myself by wondering how many people are, and of course, I've absolutely no idea. And of course, on the scale of things, there's people working at a far superior level than I. Inevitably, there are. And there's people that are total arsehole, sort of selfish idiots that are kind of like, okay, really? But at the same time, I don't, as I say, I don't know their mind. And the sort of rise of drama and chaos that's kind of rippling out over this past year or so that we know we're all aware of. There's this sense of vast turmoil and uncertainty and fear that is literally juddering through the airwaves, through the internet processes, through most people are riddled with this kind of existential gloom and fear and doubt.
Very much so.
And this is beautiful in its same way, because the system, the overall system of man's involvement, I use the man, man's involvement with the processes is becoming completely, utterly and manifestly chaotic. Complete chaos. There's chaos within people's minds, chaos within in countries, and you know, the whole process is in, you know, financial world. We're on the brink of this great chaos. And to me, that is, there's great beauty in that, because the more chaos that is active in the world, the more level the playing field becomes. No one can hold, the forces might think they've got it, but in this chaotic world, they don't know what's coming behind them or through them or up in front of them. And it kind of creates this sense in my mind of a level playing field, where the actions of any individual have the capacity to tip the scales in a positive way. So if there's, 7 billion people on the planet, perhaps, you know, all bar 100,000 are in a chaotic, fearful state. But the 100,000, let's say, or the apocryphal number is 144,000. That's the sort of metaphor number. And if the 144,000 people are working together as a team, as playing, but actually abstracted from one another, but all their intentions are in alignment, there is a connection between these people. And the act of 144,000 people, you know, a apocryphal number, but the actions of these people in the chaotic world, anything in chaos can become an attractor or a node of growth. That's the whole thing of chaos, is you think you know where the dam's going to break, but it's not. It's that
something just pops up from
and when the
field.
Chaos starts, there's no predicting a chaotic state. Naturally, there's no prediction. Cannot be predicted.
Yeah.
The biggest computers in the world can't crunch where a single raindrop's going to land. There's too many constraints that kind of guide it. And so I actually relish this time as a chance to sort of like, okay, even playing field, what's to stop any of us actually serving as a node or an attractor for growth out of this chaotic stage? And I absolutely, whether it's kind of a fool's paradise, it doesn't matter. It works for me and my construct, and it served me well. And it's like, okay, I've got to rock up and try again. I can't leave my work to anybody else to do, as no one can rely on someone else to look after us, because hang on.
Exactly.
This
time is you just said this time is very much this chaotic time, but there's a lot of opportunity in chaos, as you've just kind of so beautifully summaried. It very much feels to me like the people out, there's all the, I was one of them myself who kind of sat back and thought, when's the time doesn't feel right, I can do this, launch this project or start so-and-so, but I'm just going to be quiet and work on it away and do this thing. And then suddenly there comes a point where it's about making your voice heard or stepping out from taking a risk, in whatever way that means to you. It could be a small risk. It could be a very big risk. But those kind of steps, are where the ripple effects that you've been talking about.
Yeah, and then there's
come the, from, you know.
There's the standard phrase, isn't there? Your comfort zone and where the magic happens. Mm. So it's like, oh, I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that. No. And you do it, and it's like, wow, okay, there's the result. And this is this kind of the chaotic state naturally terrifies me because, I get swamped in whatever the chaos is going to be. And nope, temper it, bring it back. And this is the sort of...
this is the practice again of getting into mindfulness. You
absolutely.
Know?
So bring it back. It's like the sort of you have a crazy little puppy and gradually it's like... heal. And this is the purpose, this is the sort of metaphor of bringing the mind back, stay on point.
There's so many people getting understandably getting lost in the chaos, or it can be fairly overwhelming, as you know. I think a lot of people at the moment are very overwhelmed by how chaotic things are, and maybe they don't understand that perspective of opportunity, or that perspective of what they could, how they could step in and influence the course of things. It very much feels to me like, now is the time. Now is always the time, but now really is the time.
It's sort of ramp up our games and kind of like, okay, what are you doing? Mm. Yeah, and same, I kind of feel that there's probably far more people than I give credit for that are working on this understanding. You know, the spiritual seekers, the light workers.
I think there's a lot of people working under the radar, without want of any recognition or without documenting it. They're just working, doing what they feel called to do.
Yeah.
You know, I know people like that personally, multiply that by hundreds of people, thousands of people around the world, and then. They're little plugs, aren't they? Little plugs in a grid. And maybe somehow these ones can form a spark. There's a light going off here and there. The fires are started. Yeah, we'll see.
Mm.
Mark, I'm going to draw a line under that for today. Thank you so much for giving me your time and inviting me to your space and sharing these very personal stories. But I think people will be really moved to hear your experience with this, how it's translated... you know, life, the magic through the pain. The pain has formed these avenues for you to heal, and for you to then, like you say, send that out down these tributaries into the world. And I really appreciate it. Thank you. If people want to look at any of your mandalas and take them in for themselves, or find out about anything else that you're up to, do you have a website people can go to? Or
yeah, markgolding.co.uk.
Excellent. There you have it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ooh, don't really know what to say after that one. That was a very special episode, and I'm really grateful to Mark for his openness and his warmth in sharing. I do hope you got something from that. If you enjoyed it, please let me know. Hit me up on Twitter or leave a comment on the website, or however you can choose to connect. Just remains for me to say thank you to Six Organs of Admittance for the closing and opening music, which I use. And you can find out more about Ben and his work at www.sixorgans.com, and they're on Drag City Records, which is dragcity.com. If you want to look at any of Mark's beautiful and powerful mandala work and find out a bit more about his process and his magical workings, you can connect with him at markgolding.co.uk. And please share this amongst your friends, pop it on social media, give us a little review on iTunes, any kind of, if you can send 5 minutes of love our way in the form of some sharing or a small review, then that was greatly appreciated. And have a great week.
We found our way.